Whoa, there we go. My name is Steve Marks. I am going to be chatting with you all about building software as a service solutions on Windows Azure. So we'll, in a moment, we'll actually define what that means. But first, let me introduce myself. I drew that myself. Thank you very much. My blog is at blog.smarks.com. If you can remember Smarks, which is, you know, for Steve Marks, you can find me on the web. I'm at smarks.com. My email address is smarks@smarks.com. On Twitter, I'm Smarks. If you go to github.com/smarks, you find me. That's me. What was I doing before, and what am I doing now? I was a very early Windows Azure team member. How many were at PDC 2008? So that's when we unveiled Windows Azure for the first time and did our CTP. I was the guy with the red shoes doing the demo. That was my sort of role in coming out with Windows Azure. So I've been there since not quite the very beginning where they started writing code, but around the days where there was sort of a booting version of Windows Azure that ran in a lab somewhere, and we were trying to figure out what it would look like to expose it to developers. And so my first job on the team was the SDK, was building the very first SDK and figuring out how that would work. I worked on Windows Azure up until February of this year. So I worked from I guess sometime in 2007 all the way up till this year. So almost 5 years working on Windows Azure. So I have a lot of history with that product. I left recently. In February, I left Microsoft. I now do two different jobs. One of them is I'm the chief cloud architect or chief Windows Azure architect, it depends who you ask, for a consulting company called Aditi. And Aditi acquired last year a company called Cumulux. And Cumulux was like cloud partner of the year for Microsoft and doing a bunch of cool Windows Azure stuff. And now I work over there part-time and do a bunch of sort of architecture sort of stuff for them. And then in the other however many hours of the week, I'm building a startup called Site44. And so I am not only a Windows Azure expert, but I'm also now building software as a service. And so I've given a lot of thought to what it takes to build software as a service, what you need in terms of technology, how that relates to Windows Azure. That being said, I'm not building Site44 on Windows Azure. I'll tell you, before there's a lot of speculation, I'll tell you exactly why, which is that we needed some very specific kind of Linux stuff to build in our stack. Linux until like, 5 days ago or, no, I guess it's 7 days ago, wasn't available in Windows Azure. And so as we built this up, we built it elsewhere just to get that stack. But it would actually be a good fit for Windows Azure otherwise. So anytime a slide turns red, see this transition here, when it turns red, that means that that I'm saying something about Site44, like wearing this t-shirt that is really all about advertising my startup. There's only one other slide where I do this, so don't fear too much. But the one thing that I'm gonna do right now is show you where these slides are. So these slides are being driven out of my web browser here, and they're at teched.site44.com. So we do static web hosting, and so I put all my slides on there. So if you want to, if you've got a laptop or whatever and wanna follow along, this works also on, I believe, on phones. It'll work pretty well, too. So you can pull up teched.site44.com if you want to follow along. And after the presentation, that's where the slides will be. If you go download the PowerPoint deck, all it's going to do is have a URL that points you over here. Okay, so let's talk about getting the clicker to work. Let's talk about what we're going to do here and what I mean by software as a service and what it means to be building that on Windows Azure. So the first thing that we're going to do on the next slide, in fact, is we're going to define what software as a service means for the purposes of this talk. We're going to give it sort of a, we're going to cap off what we mean by software as a service. And then we're going to talk about software as a service architecture with a pretty specific kind of slant around multi-tenancy versus single tenancy. And I'll talk about what I mean by that and where there's a trade-off there and how you can kind of in different tiers do different things. So I'd say probably the majority of this talk is going to be in that kind of slice, where we're talking about architecture, we're talking about the technologies in Windows Azure, how you can use them in different architectures, and how you make the decision about what you want to do. Then we're also going to talk about SaaS billing and metering. So we're kind of get a little bit into the business model of doing SaaS, how you can map that to your cost model, and what tools you have available to kind of measure things and to bill people. So we're going to spend one slide defining what we mean by SaaS. The rest of the talk is going to be a bunch of architecture stuff, mostly around multi-tenancy, and then a little bit on kind of business model and billing. We're going to do some demos throughout, so I have a fair bit of kind of Visual Studio work that we're going to go through together to kind of build up a little demo SaaS app that I put together. So here is the working definition we're going to use for SaaS in this talk. You can see the credit. It's a definition that came from me right now, which is software that's delivered over the internet and billed on a subscription basis. This is not, if you go look up the definition of SaaS anywhere else, you will find some lengthy set of words that boils down to software that you use over the internet, which is like everything. So the only thing it's not is a pure client app that makes no network calls, right? That's sort of not SaaS. Everything else in the world is SaaS. So I kind of scoped it a little bit more. So the first part of that is kind of what everybody agrees SaaS is. I've kind of scoped it more and said there's a billing model and it's a subscription model, and that's what makes it SaaS. And so when you go to Bing and then type in a search query, that's not SaaS by my definition. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm only talking about those things where you have to sign up and you have to pay and kind of go from there. I'm actually okay with, even if you don't have to pay, if it's still sort of on a subscription basis. So if the price is zero, but it gives you a certain amount of stuff per month or something like that, I'd still kind of call that SaaS. But we're basically going to focus on this definition. So I hope that's okay with everybody. So SaaS multi-tenancy, let's get right into kind of the architecture of the thing. SaaS is commonly multi-tenant. I'd say this is the vast majority of the way SaaS is done. Certainly consumer-facing SaaS is done this way. As you go to sort of enterprise SaaS that's sort of sold to a business, sometimes it's not done this way, and I think largely that's for sort of security and isolation reasons, and we'll talk about how you can kind of make those trade-offs. But it's commonly multi-tenant, and that means that resources are shared among tenants or users. So very simply, if there's a, let's pick on a virtual machine. Let's say there's a virtual machine somewhere. If that same virtual machine is serving multiple users, I'm considering that a multi-tenant resource. Like that's a resource that's shared. If, on the other hand, every user gets their own VM, then that's a single tenant. That component is single tenant. The reason I'm kind of being precise with those words is that multi-tenant, as long as you have more than one user, you're kind of a multi-tenant service. But I want to get to kind of, well, each tier might actually have different properties. And so you might have web front ends that are multi-tenant, but you might have data in the back end that's single tenant. And we'll talk about that. But I think it's important to make that distinction because it's very common in architectures that I see with my work with Aditi, we'll work with, with people who are building SaaS. And it's extremely common to see one part of the system be shared and one part not be. So there's a further kind of nuance to multi-tenant that is not really going to matter for the purposes of this talk, but I want to kind of throw it out there because I hear the terminology in a lot of different ways, and I want to kind of pin it down, which is the concept of a tenant is different for different kinds of solutions. So Netflix is software as a service, right? So Netflix, you pay, and then you get to stream video over the internet, or you get DVDs in the mail. So you pay, and then you get some service that's sort of yours. So there are lots of users. It's multi-tenant because there are lots of users. There are other kinds of applications where there's a grouping of users. So where company A is a tenant of this software, company B is a tenant, and then within the companies, they have thousands of people who actually use the software. And so there's kind of this grouping that is commonly called tenants. And I think that as you talk about multi-tenant and single-tenant, another good thing to sort of ask as you hear these terms is, are you talking about each user as a tenant, or do you have some notion of a grouping of users that's a tenant? Probably won't matter much for the purposes of this talk and the architectures we're talking about. It's not going to make a huge difference, but specifically when you talk about customizing software for different tenants, sometimes this grouping actually matters, and so you have kind of a hierarchy of tenants and users. Okay, so let's talk about the decision to go multi-tenant. So you're going to spin something up. You have a few options for how you're going to service multiple users. And one is that you could just be single-tenant. You could spin up this app multiple times. Every user sort of gets their own copy of the app, if you will. Or you can go multi-tenant where things are shared. And I've got pros and cons for both, and I think it's reasonable to make this make different decisions for different projects. So the pros of multi-tenant are generally that it's really efficient. You're sharing resources, and so you get a lot kind of more density per whatever it is, per disk or per VM or per account by sharing them. So it's resource efficient. It tends to have a lower operational cost because there are fewer things that you have to manage, because you're running like one app that serves, you know, all your users rather than running thousands of apps, each one servicing one user. So the operational cost tends to be lower. It's much more resource efficient because you're sharing, right? Same reason we go to virtualization instead of raw machines. You may go to a multi-tenant service rather than single-tenant service. The cons. I already feel bad for writing difficult here, but difficult implementation, and I mean in sort of contrast to doing a single-tenant service, there's some work that goes into building a multi-tenant service. It means that everything in that service has to be aware of which user this is and what data is his, and make sure that he doesn't access somebody else's data and do the customization that's right for that user or that tenant if you have that kind of hierarchy. And so it's a little bit tricky. You do have to do additional work to get this done. And specifically, there are challenges around isolation of tenants. So as soon as you're sharing resources, you have all these challenges about, well, what if I'm a resource hog? And now somebody else can't use the thing because I'm dragging down the performance of the whole app. Or what if I try it? What if I am accessing somebody else's data erroneously, right? But because you have a bug, there's a security isolation question. What's the boundary? How do we make sure that we're not delivering user A's data to user B or letting user C delete somebody else's data? And so you have to think about these isolation in terms of security and performance as the main ones. And so it's a little more difficult. So I guess what I'm saying is that there's work you have to do to get this. Single tenant, the pros are it's comparatively easy to implement, and that's particularly true if you're migrating existing software. So one thing that I see very commonly these days is ISVs who had a sort of shrink wrap product that they sold to be installed inside an enterprise, right? They sold shrink wrap software, gets installed inside the enterprise, and run single tenant, right? Because that enterprise is one tenant. They're now making the move to Windows Azure or to another cloud and trying to turn this into a service. And there, single tenant in the cloud isn't a very appealing model because you already had software that worked single tenant, right? That didn't have to deal with sharing resources or customization depending on who's logged in, things like that. And so moving that over to the cloud is comparatively easy. So single tenant has that pro that it tends to be easier to implement. And you know, as a sort of corollary of the multi-tenant challenges around isolation, single tenant has very good isolation properties in that, well, every tenant's in their own silo, they're not connected to anybody else. I don't have to worry very much about those security and performance isolation problems. And the cons are, again, corollaries of the multi-tenant ones. It's a little less efficient, or perhaps a lot less efficient, depending on how many tenants you have and the kind of resources they use, because everything is not shared. So at night, when everybody in one country stops using the app and people in another country start using the app, you don't get any benefit from that because you're not sharing the resource. There's some resource that's just sitting there idle because no one's using it. So it's less efficient in terms of the resource, and there are more things to manage because now each tenant has their own something. Right? What the something is, we'll talk about it as we kind of go to the tiers and multi-tenancy within that. But because you have more things, you have sort of a thing per user or per tenant, you have more things to manage, that tends to raise that operational cost and make it a little more difficult to do. So I tend to steer people, I'm a big believer in multi-tenancy. I tend to steer people there for economic reasons and for sort of efficiency reasons. But you really need to look at existing code that you have, the requirements you have for isolation, things like that, and make the decision that's right. And as we get into sort of multi-tenancy in an N-tier architecture, you can see that you can actually make different decisions at different tiers of the app. And I think that's often a good idea. So I'm going to give a very brief what N-tier architecture is. And the number N is 3 in this slide. But the second tier is sort of where sometimes there are more layers. But an N-tier architecture is, you know, instead of just client-server, right, that was our two-tier architecture that we've largely as an industry moved away from. It was, you know, sort of a client talking to, often directly to a database or something on sort of the server side. An N-tier architecture, there's a client, there are some services that it uses, And the services in turn rely on some back-end data. And so that's sort of the three tiers that we have here. The service tier is sometimes many tiers. It really depends on kind of how it's built. And that's where N tier comes from, that there may actually be a lot of things in between. But basically, we've moved sort of data off to one end. The client lives here. And these days, and in most of what we talk about with Windows Azure, the client is a browser. And so it's a single tenant. It sits on my machine kind of thing. The services and data, though, we have a choice. We get to make a decision of whether those services are going to be multi-tenant or single-tenant. And in the data layer, we get to make a decision about whether these are going to be single-tenant or multi-tenant. So for each tier, multi-tenancy means sharing resources. So if this service is serving more than one person, it's multi-tenant. If the database holds data for more than one person, then that's multi-tenant, et cetera. So let's pick apart a couple slices of this, and we're actually going to do a demo of each one of these. So let's start with identity. And talk about multi-tenancy in identity. And really, what this boils down to is that users are logging in, right? There's some sort of identity associated with a user. That typically means there's some sort of username and password, or that might be their Active Directory credentials, or that might be them logging in with Facebook Connect or whatever. But some identity, they have some way to authenticate and get into the system. And then you look up their tenant. And remember, again, there's a hierarchy where there may be users that are part of a group and they're part of a tenant, or the users might be their own tenants. Either way, you're sort of looking up that user, and then the rest of their activities are sort of scoped within that tenant. And that's kind of how a multi-tenant service works. The other model is that users kind of, that rather than having to look up what tenant this user is a part of, the user does that for you. So this is the, well, for company A, we're going to give them myawesomeservice.companya.com, and that's where their users are going to go. And we're going to have myawesomeservice.companyb.com, where the company B users go. And the company A users just won't be able to log in to company B, and vice versa. And so they're sort of separated before they even log in. They've come to the tenant that they want to talk to, and then they have to sort of authenticate themselves as a member of that tenant. So those are two slightly different approaches to this. It's sort of, it's all kind of about endpoints and sort of where people come into the thing. But at the end of the day, you have a user and you know what tenant they're part of and you're managing from there. Two technologies that really help with this are access control and Active Directory Federation. And in fact, you often use those two together. Access control is one way that you can use Active Directory Federation to log people in with their like corporate credentials. And so those are the two technologies I'd look for. We're going to do... I want to switch to the demo. Let's do the demo right now. Can we do that? Yeah. Let's go to do the demo right now. And we're going to do access control. We're going to use access control to log people in with Live ID. But you know access control can let people use Facebook, Yahoo, Google, OpenID, Live ID. Is that all of them? I don't know. The list keeps growing. Or Federated Active Directory. I mean, I could use ACS and then log in with my corporate credentials from Aditi and get to the NAP that way, too. So we'll use access control with just Live ID, just trying to kind of keep the demo really simple. And I built this demo app that actually you guys can try if you want. It's at smarksfs.azurewebsites.net, which means that it's hosted using those new Windows Azure website things that are also only a week old. But for those who haven't followed that news, the Windows Azure websites are basically, they actually come in two modes. There's sort of a shared and a reserved mode. But it's kind of like shared hosting. I don't want to make this sound negative, but it's kind of like shared hosting, but in Windows Azure. So you sort of spin up a website, maybe you FTP your files there, or you push them up with Git, and it's sitting on an IIS machine somewhere running. So it's like going to a shared hoster who's doing Windows IIS hosting, but it's kind of baked into Windows Azure. It's part of your Windows Azure account. It runs in the same data centers as Windows Azure storage and things like that. So we're going to use that, and that's where this is hosted. So this is smarksfs.azurewebsites.net, and I'm going to log in with my Live ID. And this is what the site does. At first, it forces me to pay money before I even know what it does. It's actually awful. It's a good strategy, because once people know what the service does, they might not think it's worth paying for. Right? So that's a little tip for you. But this is in sort of a test mode. Don't actually type in credentials, although they never get to me, but don't type in your actual credit card number. If you just leave it with 42424, whatever, this all works, and you submit payment. and you get to this thing, which lets you upload files, and then after you upload them, it lets you look at them, download them again. It's a really, this is why people wouldn't pay up front if they knew what it did. So it's a little like SkyDrive, but worse and costs a lot more. This is not what my startup does, by the way, just to be clear. This is a fictitious example. So this is what it does. And if you are visiting those, actually everyone seems to be paying attention instead of with their laptops, but which is great. But if you were on your laptop and going to this, you would not see my file. This is the multi-tenancy part of this. As soon as you log in with your Live ID, you've got your own space with your own stuff in it. And that's what building a multi-tenant service is all about, right? So you can't see my files, I can't see your files, I can't affect you by doing anything weird. That's kind of what we're trying to achieve with this. So I have another version of this which runs locally. Let me fire this one up. Or try to. Not that. Hey. I'll do it the old-fashioned way. Oh, I don't want to debug, though. I want to start with that. Where's the thing to do, like, you know, Control F5, what Control F5 is supposed to do? All right, fine. We'll do it that way. So this is hopefully going to go to... Oh, you can detach after. How do I do that? Debug. Oh, I can't. It's one of these, well, I'm using Visual Web Developer Express, and somehow that makes me a second-class citizen. Okay, this worked. Now I just stopped debugging and started debugging again. That seems to have worked. Okay, so, I had a line in here that I don't actually want there yet. Let me get rid of this. That's why I didn't want to debug, because I know I'm going to change this every few seconds. Okay, so I have this version that doesn't do anything, and we're just going to sort of build it up as we go. So this version, it just says hello world. We've got a controller that just sort of spits out hello world. This is just ASP.NET MVC3. Even if you're not familiar with that, there's nothing that's going to be too hard to follow in here. And the first thing that I want to do is I want to do that login part. I want to do the authentication part. Where somebody actually has to log in to use this app. And the way that I did this, I've already sort of got this code in here, but we're gonna go out to the Windows Azure portal and you'll see sort of where it came from. So on the Windows Azure portal, there are two of these, by the way, now. You know, there's a new one that everybody loves because it's fancy looking. That has all the new stuff in it. This is where you'll find the new Windows Azure websites and the virtual machines and things like that. However, there's some things that aren't here yet. So you can't just sort of move over to this preview portal, even if you like it, and just use it. For example, access control, as far as I know, unless I'm missing something, is not available in here. It's not one of the things that's kind of over in the new portal yet. That's because this new portal is a preview. It'll get there. So I'm in the portal classic, we'll call it, and managing my access control service. So all I did in here is I went and I clicked new, and I named an access control service, and I called it Smarks TE12 for TechEd 12. And now I can click this button and actually manage it. And so here, I've already set everything up. So I said that I want to use Windows Live ID, and I set up some relying party applications. That just means the apps that are going to receive the login from this. They're using this kind of auth. They rely. They are the party that relies on this, if you will. So I have one for actual Smarks FS running in the cloud, and then I have one for localhost that just bounces people back to localhost so I can do all my testing here. I'm just using Live ID. I have a symmetric key that just kind of gives me that lets me kind of validate that the token's okay, et cetera. So let me back up, because I just want to make sure people know what access control does. And I think I can explain this very simply. So access control does something called claims-based authentication. And claims-based authentication means that it's all about claims. So you as a user are coming to my website and you are claiming, hey, I'm so-and-so, let me in to see my stuff. And I have to decide whether I believe your claim or not that you're that person. And what access control does is it validates that you are really that person, and then it gives you a signature I mean, it's actually, it's cryptographic signature, but you can imagine it's like getting a driver's license that's got the special hologram on it. And if you show me that and I flash my light at and pretend I know what I'm doing, and there's some little hologram, and I go, okay, this came from the government, I believe you that you're this person, right? That's what access control does. So you come to me and you say, hey, I want to use this, and I go, well, tough, go get an ID first. And you go over to access control and you say, well, here I am, you log into live ID, whatever, you come back. Access control goes, okay, now I know who you are. Here's a piece of paper you can go take. Here's a signature that you can take back to Steve. And now Steve will believe you. And then you come back to me. You give me the signature. I validate it. I make sure that that actually came. I have a key that access control has, but you don't have. So you can't forge this. They have the key. I have the key. I can look and make sure it really came from those guys. And now I believe you, and I believe who you are. That's what access control does in a nutshell. There's a lot of protocol-y stuff that's going on, but all of it boils down to that. It's this three-party thing. It's you, it's me, and access control is sort of an intermediary helping to authenticate. So all of this just boils down to settings then on how the signature comes, what the format is, and all that sort of stuff. So I've set this stuff up. When it came time to actually do anything with it, I went over here, and I got a URL. And this is where I send you. So if you come to my service and you want to use it, the way I send you to access control is I use this URL, which says it's hard to pick anything out of here, but somewhere in here it has a realm that says like localhost 54321, which is where this is hosted. And the URL says the host name is smarxte12.accesscontrol.windows.net. So that's what says it's part of this access control thing. And then the realm says, and here's where it's good and where you're going to send the person after they've done this, so what they're trying to authenticate to when they do this. So I took this string, and I went into my web config. And I put it here. So I put authentication mode equals forms, and then I said forms login URL equals that access control URL. By the way, if you do things what many people will tell you is the right way, as opposed to the way that I did it, you may use Windows Identity Foundation, and it'll just sort of set this stuff up for you. It'll put this in your web config, and it'll handle the token when it comes back. I play around with Windows Identity Foundation and putting it in websites, and it's got this weird, it wants to be in the GAC and not bin deployed, and so it's a little bit tricky to kind of get it going. And I kind of got frustrated and instead wrote about 40 lines of code, I'll show you in a second, that parsed the token by hand. So I just sort of re-implemented it because developers love to reinvent wheels, and so I did it. It also taught me a lot about what the structure of the token is, so it was instructive, but I did that. So most of the time, you won't have to do this by hand, but this is all that I've done. There's not a lot of magic here. I've said authentication mode equals forms. Here's the login URL. When they come back, they come to this, which is the about 40 lines of code I told you I'd show you, which get a result back, and you have to like base64 decode it, and then it's XML, and you have to pull out a little part. And I think that part is also base64. I don't know how many times I'm doing. There's a from base64 and a to base64, and then another one. But all I do is sort of pull that apart. I check the signature. I mean, that part's really important, right? To make this actually secure, this part is really, really important, which is I create the signature from the string that you gave me, and I check that it's the same signature that you gave me. And now I know, okay, this really did come from access control. I can really believe you that you are who you say you are. And then eventually, I do this line, formsauthentication.setAuthCookie, which is the way in ASP.NET to just sort of save an identity in a cookie. And so I've basically converted all this stuff. So I got back from LiveID some GUID. It doesn't actually say your name or your email address, but it gives me some pairwise unique identifier, which means every time you come to my website, you'll have that same identifier. But if you go to somebody else's website, you'll have a different one. And that's good, because that means I can't track you across websites and things like that. So I get that, and I stick it in a cookie, and now you're logged in. Now I know who you are. So now I can do stuff like, in this home controller, I can say authorize, which is the way you tell MVC that this is a protected thing, so they have to log in first. And once they're logged in, they'll have an identity. So I can say, you are, and then use user identity.name, and spit it out. So now if we go back here and we load this home page, we'll get an identity. So it flashed really quickly. It did send me over to LiveID, but I was already logged in because I logged into the portal. So you didn't see me type a username and password, but the same thing would happen. And now that's the magic thing that LiveID uses as an identifier for me. Every time I log into this application, I will get that same ID. So this is the way that we know I'm the same guy who I was yesterday when I came in and signed up. So I think that's about it for this demo. I think we're going to leave it at there at that point. So what we have at this point is we have an application that can log people in using access control services, just stores that as a cookie, so for the duration of that session we know who you are, and doesn't do anything in particular yet with it. So we have sort of the identity part of multi-tenancy. We don't yet have any actual actions that we're doing with that. We don't let the user do anything. So stepping back, because I skipped over this slide earlier, let's talk about multi-tenancy in services. So let me erase these things. I did them in this build for a reason. So I just want to, at this point, I mentioned what websites are before. Cloud services are what you've seen in Windows Azure for the past 4 years. Those are web roles and worker roles, if you're familiar with that model. That's kind of that's how those things work. That's still there. I think it's still great. So despite the fact that we're all jumping around telling you all about these new things, websites and virtual machines, the cloud services are actually awesome. They're where sort of the most kind of unique platform as a service capabilities come in with Windows Azure, I'd say. And then we have virtual machines, which are also brand new and exciting, which is the infrastructure as a service part of Windows Azure. So that's where you can just spin up a Windows VM or a Linux VM, in fact, and use it as you would any virtual machine. So there's not a lot done for you there. It's not platform as a service. It doesn't sort of raise that abstraction layer. But it helps you to spin up machines and kind of get things on there. And in particular, when you're looking at, when you're looking at porting an app and doing it single tenant in the cloud, I think a lot of people are going to go to virtual machines and they're going to take their app as it is and they're just going to run it on that virtual machine. And when a new tenant comes in, they'll spin up a new virtual machine and install their app again, but customized for that tenant and whatever. And they'll sort of do these as single tenant things. It'll be an easy migration, but it won't look very different from running it in your data center. And that's kind of by design. Yeah, you had a question? I would call it PaaS. So the question was, are websites part of the new IaaS thing? I would call it PaaS, although I don't know that we're calling, do we call GoDaddy PaaS? Right? So GoDaddy offers shared hosting and whatever. There are people who adamantly are saying no to whether we call them PaaS. Then I don't know I don't know exactly how in this taxonomy to talk about websites, but I wouldn't call them IaaS because they're not infrastructure, right? The infrastructure as a service thing is really about like a raw, like a network and a VM, and they're sort of at a low level. While websites are actually about, well, here's my ASP.NET app, run it for me, right? And it's a little like shared hosting, although the reserve model is actually a little more like cloud services. And so that's why I'm not really sure where to fit it in. It's if you have to call it PaaS or IaaS, I think you call it PaaS. If you have other options for what you call it, it's probably one of those other ones, and I don't know exactly how to do it. Does that make sense, though? I mean, the websites are really, they're software as a service? Yeah. Yeah, application as a service. It's just ass. Is that? Okay. I don't know. I like the debate that just happened here because I don't know how to talk about these either. I don't know how to put these sort of in a taxonomy that works for everything. David Chappell has a taxonomy. I know he does. Go ahead. Oh, okay. And I should have read it. Yeah. I'm gonna repeat that just because the recording, I want to make sure the recording has this in it, which is that the taxonomy, so David pointed out there's a white paper that he wrote. So if you look for David Chappell's white paper on WindowsAzure.com, you'll find a taxonomy for these things that calls virtual machines, infrastructure as a service, cloud services, platform as a service, and websites, web hosting as the taxonomy. And as he points out, web hosting and PaaS are kind of close in what they do. So that's good. I like that taxonomy. I think that works. I think people know what web hosting is. I think people kind of get PaaS and IaaS. And so I think that kind of works. Cool. So these are your three options that you have these days to run something in Windows Azure. So if you're running an app in Windows Azure, it might be any of these ways. And you can use them in combination. Last week, I actually spun up a website running ASP.NET that talked to a Linux VM that was running Redis over a virtual network. And so it's not that you can't compose these things in interesting ways. It was a web role. I think I misspoke. I think I said a website, but it wasn't. It was a cloud service. You actually can't yet connect a website to a virtual network, to these other things. But a cloud service, so I was running a web role, it was ASP.NET, and then it was talking to one of these virtual machines. So when you talk about multi-tenancy, you have ways to do multi-tenancy in each of these different forms. So in a website, the shared model, remember there's a shared model and a reserved model. In the shared model, the shared model of websites is a multi-tenant service already, and you're the tenant. So you're sharing with other people, and there are multiple things running on that box. But as you turn around and use it, and you have tenants, you still have a decision of whether your website is serving multiple tenants or it's serving only one tenant. It's actually kind of nice to use the shared model to build a single tenant service. And the reason for that is that they're kind of inexpensive. These websites, particularly today, you get to run like 10 for free for the next year, I think. And then even beyond that, I suspect there's a significant free tier. They're fairly resource efficient, so even if you spin one of these up for one tenant, you're not losing a lot in terms of the resource efficiency, as I talked about sort of the trade-off there. So the shared model is kind of good if you're trying to run single tenant. It's very easy and fast to spin up a new thing. So if somebody signs up, you can actually right then spin up a new website and give it to them. It takes on the order of, you know, like 5 to 10 seconds, and then it's up. And so it's actually an appealing model. I haven't yet seen anyone do this because it's brand new, but it's an interesting model, I think. There's a dedicated model, and those look a lot like cloud services. So in the dedicated model, you actually have VMs that are dedicated to running that website. And then it looks pretty much like the web role does in a cloud service. And so I think that how you use that is pretty much the same as what we'll talk about in the next bullet. So for cloud services, you have a good isolation boundary in cloud services. So remember, I was talking about one of the trade-offs that you have to think about is the difficulty in kind of isolating tenants from each other. A cloud service has a very rigid isolation boundary in that it's actually, there's a virtual network. You can extend these sort of things and join more things. But by default, every cloud service is in a virtual network where nothing can kind of get in and out except through kind of defined endpoints. And so things are running on different virtual machines. So you've got a performance isolation. They're within their own virtual network. You've got network and security isolation. It's a good way to kind of define that boundary. And so if you are running single tenant and doing those in cloud services, you've got a really good boundary defined already. That said, if you're in the single tenant mode and you think what you're going to do is spin up a new cloud service for each tenant as they come in, you do have to worry about that resource inefficiency. And it's not that inexpensive to spin up. If you're spinning up one of these per tenant, unless they're really making use of that full virtual machine, you're paying for a VM when really all you wanted was something smaller. And it takes, on the order of, 8 minutes or so to kind of spin one of these things up. So it's also not something you'll do on demand when someone signs up. You could. I actually have seen that model implemented. But it's a little bit, I'll send you an email when your service is up and running, which isn't quite what you usually want. Virtual machines are, in fact, cloud services. The portal plays some tricks here, but under the cover, when you spin up a virtual machine, it's not to say that these two things are exactly the same, but in terms of the boundary and how they're run and whatever, when you spin up a virtual machine, it is inside a cloud service. It's just, at the moment, the only thing in there. And so it has the same benefits of kind of that network security isolation and performance isolation as you have in cloud services. It also still takes a few minutes to spin one of these up. And so it's again, not something you'll sort of do trivially and all the time. And it has the same cost model as cloud services. You're paying by the VM. So those are kind of those models. And again, you're kind of choosing multi-tenant or single-tenant in each of these. Okay, so this is what we saw in sort of the identity thing. Let's talk about multi-tenancy and data. So remember, there are these three tiers, at least, that we've defined. One of them is a client web browser, so there's no multi-tenancy happening there. But we've talked about the services. The one that's remaining is the data. So what does multi-tenancy look like in data? I'm going to talk about two different things. One is Windows Azure Storage, which is like blobs, tables, and queues. It's probably misleading to put queues in there, but so blobs and tables, effectively, for what we're talking about here. And then I'll talk about SQL on the next slide. So those are kind of the two views we're going to take a look at. So in terms of Windows Azure Storage, you really have, I think, three options that are viable. One is that you have one account per tenant, so everybody has their own storage account. This has awesome isolation properties, but you can only have so many accounts. I think by default you can only have 5 storage accounts in a subscription, and if you beg and plead, you get up to 20. I think those are the numbers. Maybe they're higher, but there is a finite limit. You can't just have a new account for every user if you're going to be beyond sort of a handful of these. And so you're sort of, your hands are tied a little bit in using this model. That you can ask Microsoft to extend the limit. But how high can you ask them? When I was at Microsoft and I asked as a Microsoft employee, I think they all still only gave me 20, or maybe it was 100, but there was still it was still the kind of resource that they didn't want there to be billions of, I think was they really didn't like the model of you spinning up an account for each user and sort of thing. So, I agree. It is ideal in terms of isolation. I think there are just challenges to actually getting it going. But you do make a good point, which is the limit that you get out of the box is not the limit. You can talk to Microsoft and get those things raised. Yeah? Yeah. So to summarize for the recording, look, you can ask Microsoft, you can get these limits raised. Some experience in the room says it's actually very hard to get the limits raised, and just the fact that you want it for isolation of different tenants or whatever is not working as sort of justification to get those limits raised. So I think my advice here stands that it's a glorious option for isolation. It's pretty much infeasible if you're going beyond a few accounts. I think that you'll get stopped pretty quickly from spinning up the number of accounts that you want. So the second alternative is to do a partition per tenant. And blobs and tables in Windows Azure have partitions. They're sort of structured in different ways for blobs versus tables. But a partition is the sort of unit of atomicity, that's a good word. But they're sort of the unit at which you can't sort of break up the partition further. So a partition is the thing where if we have to spread things out for load and put those across many storage servers, a partition defines sort of where that boundary, what that minimum size is that has to all be kind of served from one server. So they act as sort of the performance isolation thing in storage. And I will tell you that under the hood inside of storage, there isn't a lot of difference in terms of how they're treated between different accounts, each with one partition, and one account with two different partitions. Like the implementation for the most part treats those things as the same thing. To the system, they're just things that can be split across. That's not universally true. Those aren't equivalent concepts. But in terms of performance isolation, that's sort of how it works, is that the partition is what's separated. So this has very good performance isolation. If you isolate people in different partitions, you do have a cap of sort of what an account can do in terms of transactions per second. But as long as you're under that, the partitions will sort of behave independently in terms of performance. So that's good. It's typically pretty easy to implement because you often have something like a tenant ID that you can use as your partition key and just say, well, this tenant is in that partition, and you're done. And different tenants are isolated into different partitions, and you can kind of move on. They're limited in terms of their management and security isolation, though. The key that you use to access all these different partitions is the same. So it's the same security credentials going in here. And so it's a little hard to manage that security isolation. It means it's back up to your app level, and it's your job to make sure you're not letting somebody access the wrong thing. It would be a little easier if they were different accounts, and so you had different credentials. And so that's kind of what you lose as you go to this one partition per tenant. And there's just one account, so you can't delete you have to delete a partition of data, which is actually a little tricky. You kind of have to enumerate the partition to know what to delete, versus if you had different accounts where you could just delete one or create a new one, and they'd be managed independently. So that's kind of the trade-off. And the third one is that you have no isolation, or you've externalized the isolation to sort of the app layer. By which I mean, you're going to have all the data kind of intermixed, but it's at your app layer, you're going to know whose data is whose and kind of manage that. But they aren't going to be partitioned separately, or perhaps they're partitioned totally separately. So in blob storage, a blob is a partition. So like a single file is the partition. Forget containers. In terms of performance isolation and whatever, the blob is actually the partition. And so there, you may just have lots of blobs, and some blobs belong to that guy, and some blobs belong to here, and metadata tells you which one, or maybe the hierarchy tells you where they are. And it's up to your app to sort of decide who gets access to what, and whatever. And that's actually, it's fairly common because of the way blobs do partitioning. You often have each blob is a partition, so now you have many partitions that belong to a single tenant, and so you don't have that one-to-one mapping. There's nothing wrong with this. It sounds bad to say, like, no isolation or external, but it's not inherently wrong. It's just one of these options of sort of how you manage this. So in SQL, you have similar kind of things. You can have one database per tenant. You can have a table per tenant, which is sometimes a little awkward to implement because not a lot of frameworks you use to access SQL are sort of oriented around there being a different table name for a different tenant. But depending on what you're using, if you can work that out in your code, it's actually a kind of neat way to do the partitioning. And then you can do federation, which is sharding. So federation sounds kind of cool. It does neat stuff for you, but when it boils down to how you're laying out the databases, it's sharding. And so you've done horizontal partitioning. You've put users A through F over here and users J through M over here. And did I skip like G and H and I? You sort of partition them out by ranges of keys sort of thing, and then that's the sharding that you use. What SQL Federation does for you, so if you use the federation that's built into what's now called Windows Azure SQL databases, what it will do for you is automatically route you to the right place. So your query will say, I'm working on tenant number 3, and that will, you actually use federation and then tenant equals 3, and that will take you right to the right database that has that tenant on it. And so at your app level, as long as you're always doing the use federation thing and specifying ID, you can be pretty confident that you're not accidentally accessing the wrong user's data. Whatever. You're routed to the right place. And I think that's the big thing in terms of multi-tenancy and isolation. That's the big thing that federation does for you, is helps you to do that. In terms of performance isolation, one database per tenant gives you very good isolation. As you go to federation, you get a little performance isolation because you've sharded. So now, well, like only 20% of my customers are sharing this database as opposed to all of them. And so it's helped you a little bit with that isolation, but it hasn't fully isolated. You're still sharing resources. And so you're kind of in this sort of multi-tenancy on your database thing. So those are kind of those options there. I hope that makes sense. I went through the SQL ones a little fast, but okay, people are nodding. Good. Let's do some demoing. Let's do multi-tenant blob storage. So what's behind, you saw the sort of the full demo in my fictitious kind of upload download thing. What's behind that is blob storage. Every user is going to get their own container. And then within that container, they can upload as many blobs as they want. They can download them. They actually can't delete them because I didn't implement that. But they can upload them and they can download them later. And so let's actually go into the code and implement that. Okay. So rather than just telling the user who they are, let's do something for them. Let's based on who they are, access their sort of portion of the world. So this is the multi-tenant identity part. I've got their identity. I'm going to look up, well, now I know their tenant, right, because it's one-to-one. A user is a tenant. And let me get their container in blob storage. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to blobs. I'm going to get a container reference. And the name of the container is going to be the user's name. And remember, name is not actually the name. It's that weird GUID-looking thing. It's hex-encoded something or other. So I'm getting that back. And for now, I'm just going to create it if it doesn't already exist. Because we don't have our paywall yet. Remember, we're going to charge people up front before they know what the service does. But for now, we're just going to give everybody access. As soon as they log in, they're getting access. So we're going to create that container if it doesn't exist. And then we're going to, let's just send them to the view. And I apologize for having to put this in there. The view eventually is going to take a list of strings that are the names of the blobs and whatever and show it. I'm just going to pass in an empty list now so that we can get the view to kind of show up. So if you build that and refresh here, instead of seeing who I am, I should get a page that lets me upload. Okay, so now a container has been created. In fact, let's open up one of my favorite tools. Oh, great. Now how do I know which? I think this one's me. Does this one have like the newest timestamp? This is going to be fun. Okay. So probably a container has been created just for me as a process of doing this thing. And I can put stuff in there if I browse and sort of upload. So we have to implement that side of it though. So what this does is if I browse for a file, my favorite, the chrysanthemum, then I get a not implemented yet sort of error because that's what's in the code. So let's implement that. It's actually pretty easy to do file upload in MVC to a blob container. So we're going to do the same thing that we did here. We're going to get the container. Let's see. We're going to get a blob, and we're going to name it after. Let's make a variable for that, actually. We're going to get the file that was uploaded. We're going to use the name of the file to name our blob. We're going to set the content type of the blob to whatever you uploaded. So we're going to get the content type from the file that's being uploaded. We're going to make that the content type for the blob. And then we're going to upload it. So upload from stream, the input stream. And finally, we'll just redirect people back to index. Okay, so did people follow that? I mean, it's just blob API. I'm mostly typing it out rather than having it here as a snippet or having it already here, just because I like people to get in the habit of seeing how the calls work and remembering to set the content type and whatever. So hopefully that kind of helps. But that's what that does. So let's we can actually just retry this. It should post that file again. And this time, it should actually upload it. We hope. Network permitting? I actually don't know what this delay is. I did redirect at the end, right? Return redirect to action. Uh-oh. Did I already break it? Let's try this again. Okay. That time it seemed to work. It worked, but we didn't see the name of the thing because we haven't implemented the part that actually gives you the list of blobs. Remember, we put that empty list of strings? So it's showing me a list of blobs, but it's empty. And now, if I'm right, I think I'm the C18 one. Yeah, there we go. So there's the chrysanthemum picture that we just uploaded. Now we want to build the UI that kind of shows that thing. I've built the UI already, so there's a file here. The thing we're looking at is a view called index that has a for each loop that takes each string that we passed in, right? So the type of the model is just an enumeration of strings and spits out a little link to the blob. And the link to the blob works because we're gonna use something called shared access signatures. How many people know what shared access signatures are? Oh, this is a savvy crowd, a lot of you do. For those of you who don't, blob storage has this permission model where you can make everything public or things are private and require a key to access. But you can construct a special kind of URL that has a signature in it that proves you had the key when you made the URL. and then gives you access. So I can make a special URL, give it to you, and then you can view even a private blob, because the URL actually has a query string at the end that says, here's a signature, it was signed by me, I have the key, so I'm allowed to get in. Question way in the back, yeah. You may have to shout, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Then they can view it. The only thing that, so a shared access, the question was, what if I send him that URL and he shares it with his friend? Then the friend can view it. The URL gives the permissions. Now, I can limit the permissions in a number of ways, well, really in one big way, which is by time. So I can give you a URL that's only good for 5 minutes. But you can definitely share that URL and then somebody else can download the blob. Then again, you could also download it and share it, right? So there's sort of, in terms of security, I've granted you access. Once you've been able to download it, the cat's out of the bag. But yes, you can share those URLs. There's nothing that sort of makes them work only once, if that's kind of what you're looking like. Well, hey, after one download, it expires. There's nothing like that in blob storage today. Sure. Another question? Yeah. Can you restrict access by using IPs? No. It's not in what blob storage does. Now, you can always front. You don't have to do things this way, right? I could have a web service that you call to get the blob, and it could sort of fetch it from the blob and then sort of pipe it back out. And there I could look at your IP address, and I could look at cookies, and I could do whatever I wanted to. I like shared access signatures as a way to kind of offload that work to blob storage, so it's not funneling through my web front end. I'm not shoveling bits from one end to another of a pipe. I've let blob storage worry about that. But that's, if you need that kind of flexibility, I think that's what you have to do. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yep. Yeah, we'll actually see, right, the credentials you can give are a little granular, and you can go even further with it. So if you're really interested, go look up shared access signatures. There's actually a bunch of documentation about all of the things you can do. We're going to use a subset, which is just to sort of give someone read access to a blob. So let's actually type in that code. It looks a little messy, but as we type it line by line, I think it won't be too bad. So I'm going to do it in one line, because... why not? So I'm going to do a link query to do this. So I'm going to take the container. I'm going to list all the blobs. I'm going to throw out the ones that aren't blobs. The reason I'm doing this is that list blobs actually returns you sort of a parent class of things that can give you either a blob or a prefix, which is basically a directory. So it does a kind of hierarchical thing based on slashes and the URLs. And so some of the things I get back aren't necessarily blobs. So I have to kind of cast everything. And of type is kind of the linky way to just sort of take the, just select only the ones that are of the type I'm looking for. So that's all that's doing. And then I'm going to select, B is going to be the name of my blob. Let me like already pair up parentheses so stuff works. So from that blob, I want to get the URL with that shared access signature. So I'm going to start by taking the absolute URI of the blob. So now I'm getting some URL that if you used it, wouldn't work, because it's a private container, you can't get to the blob, it would give you a permission error if you actually just used this URL without putting the right authorization headers on. But I'm going to tack on to the end of it a query string, and I'm going to do that by calling get shared access signature. Why can't I expand the parameters of, I don't know, new shared access policy. And here I'm going to set permissions, and permissions we're just going to set to read, but this is where, to your point, this is where you can actually put, it may be a little bit small, but delete permissions, list permissions, so list is like on a container, can I enumerate all the blobs, read permissions, which are what we're about to use, and write permissions, so you can actually give someone a URL where then they can just do an HTTP put and it'll save the file. It's actually really useful if you're doing like mobile development and you want to upload a photo directly from the phone to blob storage. You can use this to get a special URL that'll work and send it up there. So I'm going to set read permissions, and I'm going to just say this expires, let's do 30 minutes from now. Okay, what am I, I've got that. I did something wrong, right? Only assignments calls. Do I have to return this? Only because I put these here. I didn't need to do that.
right? I can do a single statement as a, is that right? Okay. That's what I get for trying to do it all on one line. Okay, it's building, so let's assume it's going to work. So to review this thing, we're listing the blobs, we're casting them to blobs, we're actually just selecting the subset of there are blobs and casting them, and then we're taking the URL and we're tacking onto the end of the URL with just string concatenation a signature, and the signature is going to give read permissions for the next 30 minutes. So with that, I can refresh, and if I didn't mess that up, I see chrysanthemum.jpg, and if I click on it, we get an awful URL. So this first part is just the, I realize that's tiny and impossible to read, but the first part is sort of the user identity that's me as my live ID kind of pairwise unique identifier. So that's the container name. And then chrysanthemum.jpg, that's the name. And then a shared expiry and credentials permissions and a signature. This is that shared access signature. So that's what it looks like. It's a query string. It's got a bunch of things that say like when it expires and whatever, and a signature that validates that it was made by somebody who actually has the key. So it's made by me. Okay, so that's it. So that's so now we've got people logging in, and we've got them. Everybody has their own container, and they're able to upload things and then download them again. Let's jump back over here, and later on we'll add the paywall. We'll add the sort of hey, before you can get into here, you have to pay for it. Actually, in preparation for that, I'm going to delete the container. Because later we're going to want to create it again, and there's a delay between when you delete a container to when you can create one with the same name. It's actually an async process, so you want to delete it before you're going to need to create it again. So I'm planning ahead. See, it's something I don't always do, but here I'm doing it. Okay. So hopefully this looks like the code we just wrote, because it was supposed to be the same thing that we did. We get the container based on the name, so that's where we sort of did our multi-tenant thing. Now we're zeroed in on sort of what this user's stuff is. And then we're using that to do our enumeration and our upload and things like that. Okay, so let's talk about business models. Let's talk about money and talk about the different models that you have, and then we'll talk about billing also and where this come in. This part, we'll move a little faster through some of this stuff. This is my general strategy and my advice for people who are building sustainable businesses. Figure out what your costs are and charge more than that. And I know it sounds silly and it sounds like there's not much being said there, but actually a lot of people lose sight of this. And they get really tied up in, well, how do their costs change as somebody's behavior changes, and what if this guy clicks that button a lot? And you don't actually need to necessarily care. All you need to know is what your costs look like in aggregate, and make sure that what you're charging gives you more money than that in aggregate. Like, you don't have to zero in on kind of all these things. And the reason I bring this up is that I heard a lot of things in my time on the Windows Azure team, a lot of questions from people about how can I bill a customer for exactly how many CPU cycles they used and whatever. And I think often that's not what you want to do. I'll elaborate a little bit more on that. So a few popular approaches to doing this, to figuring out your costs and charging more than that. One is this tiered pricing plan. That's very common. So if you use very few resources, that's what I use in my startup. If you use very few resources, it's free. If you use more resources, I kick you up into the paid tier and make you pay for it. So that's a specific kind of tiered pricing where one of the tiers is zero. There are other ones where, you know, there's the $10 a month plan and the $100 a month plan, and they have different features or different limits or things like that. So that's very common. Another thing that's common is just a flat rate. This service costs $20 a month. Tough. And sometimes there's fine print in there that says, as long as you don't go crazy, like, we will shut you down if you start abusing the system, right? So this is how you get out of the fear that what if he clicks the button a lot and it costs me a lot of money, is, well, you can say, look, you can only click the button so many times, and you can kind of limit people that way. So a flat rate, optionally with usage caps, is another common thing. And then the one that I hope nobody uses is utility billing. And the reason I say I hope no one uses this, so what I mean by utility billing is, well, when he clicks the button, we charge him half a cent. And if he clicks it again, he pays another half cent. And the reason I hope that you don't do this very often is that customers hate it. And I know this from experience because I worked on Windows Azure for 5 years, which does utility billing. And although it's sort of a necessary evil in the cloud, you kind of have to, the way people use it is totally different. You have to charge people in this fashion. And that's how you get the efficiency. The costs go down because I'm very tightly only charging. The guy who only pressed the button once paid half as much as the guy who pressed it twice. And that's how I can keep the prices really aligned to usage. And so it's not that it's bad to do utility billing, but customers hate it. Particularly enterprises hate it because they want a budget. I'll tell a small anecdote, even though we're running short on time, I'm going to tell an anecdote anyway, which is we had, very early on in Windows Azure, we had a group in, before we'd gone public, and we were talking to them about the business model. We had a public beta, but we hadn't gone out with a business model yet. We're talking to people about the business model and how you pay and how the utility billing works. And a guy raised his hand, he said, I work at an enterprise, we want a budget. You know, can I give you $10,000, and then you give me up to $10,000 worth of use? And our business manager is in the front of the room, and you can see him, you know, but thinking quickly and going, well, yeah, we could do that. And that's actually what if you look at, like, the commitment plans and things on Windows Azure and elsewhere, if you see utility billing and then it turns into a commitment plan, that's kind of what it is. You pay up front, and you overpay because you're paying for sort of the maximum that you're allowed to use. But you get a discount because it also helps the provider, like in Windows Azure, it helps them to know for capacity planning how much they actually have to do and whatever. And so it's kind of, it works out okay for everybody. But customers hate utility billing. They would like to know, they like predictability in their costs, et cetera. So I would hate Netflix if every time I watched a movie it cost me some fraction of a dollar or whatever. It would kill me because I'd always be afraid to start a movie and whatever. And that's what you run into. So really, do try to stay away from utility billing. Your life will be easier. It's simpler to meter if you're not doing this utility billing. And I think your customers will like it. You'll have the uncomfortable situation where you worry that someone is going to press the button too many times and you're going to be losing money on that customer. Step back, take the broad view, look at all your customers and try to do it in aggregate. That's my advice. Okay. So you have a couple options for who runs the service. In single tenant model, you have these two options. You can run the service and bill the customer, or you can give the service to the customer and let them run it. So in Windows Azure, this might mean that they spin it up in their subscription. Maybe you manage it. Maybe they give you credentials so you can kind of manage it for them. But it's running in their subscription and they pay the bill. How to bill? I'm going to boil it down to two things. You're either in some sort of store, some kind of marketplace, you're in an app marketplace, or you're in like the Windows Azure marketplace for services and things, or you're just doing payments directly. So somebody's giving you a credit card and you're just getting the money back, but it's up to you to deal with all that stuff. And the difference is the store gives you like a Yellow Pages also, like it's a marketplace, right? It's where people find your app. And so the way you decide is, do you want the benefits of that marketplace, do you already have the user and you're just trying to extract money from them? In some cases, you don't have a choice. Like, if you want to be on a mobile phone, you pretty much have to be in some sort of marketplace to do it. So things to consider as you're choosing a billing system is ease of integration, discoverability in the case of a marketplace, how does that help you? And then the customer UI, like, what experience do they get? Things to measure. So don't count CPU cycles. It's really hard. It's nearly impossible. Actually, to tell how many CPU cycles a given customer used. Maybe count VM hours if you have that kind of a service, like if you're doing compute and whatever, it may be that you spin up a whole VM for somebody to do something and you count that. And maybe count bandwidth, particularly for something like what I just built here, where you can upload files and download them, the big cost might be bandwidth. If you download the file a lot, like you share that URL with a bunch of people and they all download it, that may cost me a bunch of money in bandwidth, and so I may want to actually meter on that. Often you'll count data size, but it depends if you're worried about it. But again, in the case of sort of what we're building, if people upload gigabytes and gigabytes of stuff, that's going to cost me tens and tens of cents a month. It's not a lot, but it will add up. And I may want to meter based on that. So how to measure? Log. The main thing you want to do is log what you need. You can use built-in diagnostics. That come in Windows Azure, there's a diagnostic system, or you can build your own that just logs things to a SQL database or to a table or something like that. The next thing you do is use some of the analytics that are built in the system. In particular, I just wanted to call out Windows Azure Storage has this analytics system where they'll tell you things like how much total storage an account is using, or they can write out logs of every time someone accessed a file or things like that. So even if you're not funneling those bits through your front end, they're going right to blob storage, blob storage can kind of can mark for you how many times something's been downloaded and things like that. Note that for capacity, it's only at an account level. You can't get like a per container kind of view of capacity. And as a last resort, you can use the billing data that Windows Azure gives you, because you do get a very detailed bill for those of you who are already using Windows Azure. You probably don't try to print it out. You get like the whole thing that says line by line exactly what happened. That data can kind of can be used for some things. It's not terribly easy to consume, but for a single tenant service, it's not that bad. For a single tenant service, you'd get to look, oh, for that service, here's what it cost, and you could pass that on. But again, now you're back into utility billing, which I claim your customers will hate. We're gonna skip this one because we're short on time. I'll probably put up a blog post later with all the code, and so if you wanna see, the idea was gonna be we would add a worker role to the service, so we just add a separate service that's running a worker role. Every once in a while it looks at the usage in terms of capacity, so per container it'll kind of look at who's using what, and shut down an account if it's over a certain threshold. So I'll probably put that code online and you can kind of take a look at it later. This is a red slide, which means it's all about self-promotion, and I think I'm gonna skip it so that maybe we can do a couple questions before we have to leave. So my summary and advice is decide about per tier tenancy, and the main things to consider are cost and isolation requirements. So figure out, so the cost is mostly in terms of resource sharing. How can you get efficiency out of that, lower your cost that way? And then isolation requirements. Do you need a firm sort of security boundary around these things? Do you need a performance boundary around these things? Decide on a business model considering your costs, what your customers want. They don't want utility billing, they want something predictable, and what you can measure. Maybe there's something that you'd like to sort of bill on, but it's really hard for you to pin down what that's actually costing and how to bill for that. And use Windows Azure when you can. Windows Azure has a lot of stuff in here, and it's also it's a good platform to be on in terms of being sort of the partner ecosystem also. So you'll find that a lot of people have gone through this. They've built SaaS things. They've figured out how to bill for them. They've done it. So there's a lot of kind of knowledge in the community that you can take advantage of. Okay, so we have just a couple minutes if we want to do a couple questions here. Those are all my URLs and whatever. Feel free to send me mail or tweet to me or whatever afterwards, and I'll be around. I'll probably be over by the Windows Azure booth in the expo hall later. So thank you very much, and if you do have a couple questions, we can do those even right now. So. Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Steve?
Yes.
Okay. Great session, but quick
thank
question.
You.
When you're trying to build a really, when you're starting out, right, and you're real small on a SaaS, on Azure, and you're doing .NET, is there an easy way, we have two roles, we have a web and a worker, and the worker obviously isn't a website, it's just a background process, but we're in .NET
yep.
and everything. Is there an easy way to combine those? Like service definition or something where you're not paying double the roles for all of your redundancy and all that?
Yes. The easy way to combine a web role and a worker role is to take the code that's in workerrole.cs and copy it and paste it into webrole.cs. Because webrole is, it runs the whole life cycle. There's webrole.cs with onstart and run and whatever. It's all the same stuff as a worker role. But it also spins up IIS and points it at your site. And so if you really want to run the two on the same box, you know, on the same VM, just use webrole.cs instead of workerrole.cs and do exactly the same stuff. And you just have to be conscious of that you're sharing the VM, so don't do two things that are memory intensive on the same box, you know, that sort of thing. But it's actually pretty easy to combine.
Okay. A follow-on question. MVC, is that still a good candidate for the websites?
I mean, yes.
Yeah?
That's what I did here. This was all websites and it was MVC. And it's what I recommend. And MVC 4 will come along at some point. It's not available there yet, but so today do MVC 3. But it's my tool of choice for .NET web development.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah.
So question about the performance. Is there any performance when you're accessing blob in a big container versus kind of like a container per client?
Makes no difference.
Okay.
The isolation boundary in all senses, the partition is the full name of the blob, which is container and then whatever the path. And so each blob is in its own thing. So you get like 60 megabytes per second, is that right?
Right.
That you can get from
in
a single blob. Those are all per blob. Now, if you're enumerating,
Right. The more you enumerate, the longer it'll right. take, and the more calls you have to make to get to the end. But in terms of actually downloading a blob or whatever, it should be absolutely no difference.
All right, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we do have to sort of vacate the room, and it is lunchtime. But I'll still be, if you want to come up and ask something, I'll still be around for a few more minutes, and then you can find me at the booth later. Thanks again.